This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The following feature is paid and presented by the Department for Business and Trade.
My uncle was diagnosed with cancer, and I learned that a significant number of my family members, more than five, had a history of cancer. I decided to be part of Massive Bio to help cancer patients globally and potentially help find a cure faster through clinical trials.
Welcome to the United Kingdom, where the brightest tech innovators reshaping our world are celebrated. This year, the Department for Business and Trade are spotlighting global, trailblazing entrepreneurs through the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. The winner of the AI category was Massive Bio, whose co-founder is Charti Chujulo.
Our company is at the forefront of integrating artificial intelligence into oncology, aiming to revolutionize cancer treatment and clinical enrollment. The Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards means a lot to the team that work with us in the Department of Business and Trade. So it's a great recognition of the efforts and impact to cancer patients globally. It's a testament of trust and interest that will fuel our growth. The UK offers a vibrant ecosystem for tech innovation with access to worldwide class research institutions. By establishing a presence in the United Kingdom, Massive Bio can tap into this rich pool of talent and collaborate with leading experts in artificial intelligence and healthcare, enhancing our capabilities and positioning us as a key player in the United Kingdom's artificial intelligence landscape.
From cutting-edge AI to digital trade solutions, these innovators are building tomorrow's world today. Learn how the United Kingdom supports tech pioneers at great.gov.uk/UKPA.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Donald Trump sets out his vision for US trade to the assembled leaders at the World Economic Summit. So how will his policies affect countries with important US trade links and nowhere else to go? We're going to hear from Ireland. Also, a $7 billion deal to compensate those devastated by the US opioid epidemic. But will those who caused it really pay the price?
The Sackler family is worth somewhere between $11 billion and $13 billion. So even after they pay out this money, they'll be billionaires.
And how much should you be charged to climb the world's highest mountain? Now, if anyone had any doubts about the way Donald Trump's going to deal with the global economy, his address to the national and business leaders gathered at the World Economic Forum in Davos left really no confusion. Speaking from Washington, he said businesses should make their products in the United States if they wanted to avoid facing tariffs. He promised manufacturers the lowest taxes of any nation on earth if they produce goods in America, but he warned that if they didn't, they'd have to pay. He also criticized what he sees as unfair treatment by the European Union.
I'm trying to be constructive because I love Europe. I love the countries of Europe, but the process is a very cumbersome one. And they do treat the United States of America very, very unfairly with the VAT taxes and all of the other taxes they impose.
Well, all this hasn't gone down well with everybody in Davos. The head of the World Trade Organization said any tit-for-tat imposition of tariffs could have catastrophic consequences for the global economy. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala said poor countries were most at risk of being affected by trade wars.
If we have tit-for-tat retaliation, whether it's 25%, tariff 60%, and we go to where we were in the 1930s, we're going to see double-digit global GDP losses. That's catastrophic. Everyone will pay. Everyone. And the poor countries will pay even more.
So is this a catastrophic move? Well, I'm joined now by Dmitry Grzebinski, who's a former trade negotiator for Australia and author of the book Why Politicians Lie About Trade. Dmitry, thanks for being with us. I mean, it is, you know, the language is strong on both sides. Is this likely to be catastrophic for a lot of countries trying to sell their goods in the US?
It certainly has the potential to be, but I think what's really important to understand is at the moment, Donald Trump hasn't done anything on trade yet in this term. He has ordered several US government agencies to begin thinking towards what could be done. And he certainly laid out a philosophy that is very attracted to tariffs as a tool and that lays out a number of objectives and grievances. But at the moment, we are talking about potential and uncertainty, which is bad in and of itself, but is not yet action.
So who will be looking at this with greatest concern, really? I mean, is it the big trade blocs like the EU? Is it countries like the UK? Is it countries like Australia? I mean, who has most to lose?
First and foremost, it's not countries, it's individual businesses. It's anyone who is trying to make long-term decisions about where they buy their inputs from, where they position their factories, and where they make investments. If you are trying to build a supply chain and you're making investments in a factory that might not pay out on what you've put into it for many, many years, this is the kind of uncertainty that absolutely keeps you up at night. And I think secondly, it will be developing countries who, especially those that are smaller, that know that if it comes down to an all-out brawl, they lack the economic muscle to go punch for punch and to meaningfully scare off a large aggressor.
So this kind of fig leaf in a way, or I suppose you might say an olive branch in a way that Donald Trump has, which is to say, look, if you come and build your factories in the US, then you'll have a very low tax environment. I mean, are the companies you're talking about, are they going to be tempted by that?
I mean, certainly some are. And it should be said that, you know, U.S. manufacturing growth and investment in the U.S. has been strong for a number of years now. The U.S. has a decent amount going for it as a place to build a factory. And the Biden administration certainly prioritized encouraging that kind of inward investment and domestic investment through things like the Inflation Reduction Act, rather. So that's already happening. The problem is that the one thing we know about the global economy is you can't make absolutely everything in the world in the United States. Every additional factory you build after the first one is competing for more of those skilled workers, more of that prime land, more of that space on your infrastructure, which is the whole reason why we kind of all specialize in what we're good at and we spread out manufacturing around the world.
And U.S. exporters are likely to face tariffs in retaliation, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that's more of that uncertainty. No one knows exactly what Trump will do. No one knows exactly what the retaliation to Trump will be. And no one knows what Trump's reaction to the retaliation will be. So there's a great deal of uncertainty. And as you said, potential challenges to U.S. exports as well.
Dmitry, thanks for being with us. Dmitry Grzebinski there, former trade negotiator for Australia and author of the book Why Politicians Lie About Trade. So is US protectionism what we might call the new normal? I asked Eric Guzik, who's professor of management at the University of Montana.
I think it could be, especially the way that he's explaining how he plans to use tariff policy. And I think it's probably informative to look a little bit about how U.S. policy has been using tariffs in the past and how that may be a little bit different than how Donald Trump plans on using tariffs. So if we look back a little bit in the history of tariffs in the United States, it's a history of oscillation between free trade and tariff policy. So the United States really begins as a free trade nation. I'm not sure you could plan for a more free trade nation than the United States when it achieved its independence in 1783. And I'll just give you one indication of just how ingrained this was, right, in the culture at the time. So Patrick Henry, who we know for his famous phrase, "Give me liberty or give me death," he said the following during his time: "Fetter not commerce, sir, let her be as free as the air. She will range the whole creation and return on the wings of the four winds of heaven to bless the land with plenty." So I did read that. I don't memorize quotes from Patrick Henry. That would be a little bit weird. But it shows that this belief in the benefits of free trade was wide-ranging during that time. And that lasted about 4 years until about 1787. And then for a variety of reasons, U.S. policymakers begin to decide to change trade policy pretty dramatically. And that's led primarily by Alexander Hamilton, of course. And you may have seen the play. Apparently, he liked to sing. He liked to dance. But he was also a master architect of policy and a master of economic theory. So he's someone who had studied Adam Smith. He knew the origins of Adam Smith's ideas. He understood the logic of Adam Smith's ideas. And he was extremely adept at developing counterarguments to Adam Smith's beliefs of the benefits of trade specialization, what would become later known as comparative advantage in the work of David Ricardo. So I tell you all this because the origin of the use of trade policy and tariff policy in the United States is really with Hamilton's plan to encourage new industry in this new nation of the United States. So the first tariff act is enacted in 1789, and it was designed specifically by Hamilton to be a revenue generating tariff. Now, it was designed to encourage industry. So that was one side effect that Hamilton did see with the tariff policy. But the underlying goal was to transform an agricultural nation into an industrial nation, essentially turn the United States into a new form of Great Britain. So at the beginning, tariff policy in the United States is revenue generating. It's designed to encourage new industry. And it's really seen by Hamilton and others at that time to be a force behind innovation, which they believe would be needed in order to compete with the Great Britons of the world.
And now, things have changed in a way. I mean, just coming forward from that to the point where it's becoming, well, the subject is much more in focus, really. The rhetoric certainly changed from Patrick Henry to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
The policies are very different. But, I mean, are we still talking in a way about an idea of mercantilism, essentially a way of dealing with the global economy mainly by using what goes in, what comes out, zero-sum calculation?
Well, I think that's part of the calculation that the Trump administration is now looking at. So after we begin to introduce protectionism in the United States, it does really become protectionist. It grows, the rates, you know, they get higher and higher. So in 1816, the rates were raised to 20%. By 1828, the rates were raised to 50%. So that's when protectionism really takes hold in the United States. And that was an era of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. So in terms of where we started with tariff policy in the United States, most of our history is embedded with this idea that tariffs create or at least protect existing industry. That changed dramatically, of course, with the Great Depression, the Smoot-Hawley tariff. And at that point, there's really a dramatic shift back to free trade, right, and trade liberalization. And in terms of policy, that becomes the dominant policy pursued by policymakers between 1941 until the current era. So that's really why we see such this dramatic shift right now and why this is such an important topic.
Professor Eric Guzik there on some of the history behind all this. But what about the effect now? Let's take one country that could be in the firing line over the US protectionism of 2025. I'm talking about Ireland. Bobby McDonough is a former Irish ambassador to London, Rome, and to the EU, joins me now. Thanks for being with us, Bobby. I mean, Ireland has a link. Obviously, it's part of the EU, part of that trading bloc, but it has a long relationship with the US. It exports quite a lot to the US. How is it likely to fare in this environment?
Well, we have a new government today in Ireland, and it's an experienced centrist pro-European government, and it'll be here for 5 years. So that's a pretty stable factor in an increasingly unstable world. And our Prime Minister today, in his speaking to the Parliament, said that Ireland was going to seek to strengthen its three relationships. First of all, with the European Union, which is probably the most important one because we're part of the European Union. Secondly, the United States, and thirdly, the United Kingdom. So we work in different ways to do what we can in the rather unpredictable circumstances. But I think we're in a pretty strong position. That isn't to say that there isn't a real threat to us as there is to others, but we will approach the challenges without panic or catastrophizing because, as I say, we have a new stable government for 5 years. We have a strong economy. We have a budget surplus. And we have a good investment offering to US and other companies, which isn't only based on tax. So I think, rational optimism is the only way to approach these.
I hear your optimism, but let me point out that the part of what you mentioned there with tax is you have some pretty big American-based multinationals in Ireland, mainly because it's a pretty friendly tax environment. This could shake all that up.
I would say they're certainly here partly because of the tax environment. They're also here because we have an educated English-speaking workforce and because we're business-friendly. But that's not to say that the tax issue isn't an important one. But, you know, we didn't force these U.S. companies to come here. They came here to do business because they know it's a good place to do business, not least because it gives them access to the European market. And they will tend to think in the long term about their bottom line. So, you know, it's a very challenging environment, and we don't know what Trump is going to do, and he's likely to impose tariffs. But as your previous interviewee said, no one knows exactly what's going to happen. And Trump has said in his inaugural address that he was going to impose tariffs to enrich U.S. citizens. But of course, imposing tariffs is more likely to impoverish them. So there's a certain amount of debate that needs to go on in the U.S. administration, and I'm sure it is going on at the moment.
But what about Irish companies saying, OK, well, if there's going to be a good tax environment for us in the U.S., we'll move over there so we escape the problem of tariffs? Do you see many Irish companies thinking about that?
Well, look, nobody can predict the future, and I'm not saying that there isn't a challenge, but I suppose the first thing to say is that there's a huge amount of Irish investment in the US already. I mean, if you like, domestic Irish firms investing in America, I think we hover between being the seventh and the ninth largest investor in the United States and have created hundreds of thousands of jobs. It is possible that some companies, some American companies who use Dublin as their European headquarters may take other decisions, but they've been here a long time. They came here because they wanted to come here. And I just heard today that Trump announced in Davos that he was going to reduce the U.S. corporation tax rate to 15%. And that just happens to be the minimum tax rate set out in the OECD agreement and also happens to be the Irish tax rate. So it's not really straightforward. And I think we have to move forward with real caution, but also without any catastrophizing.
But also, of course, as you mentioned, as I mentioned, you are a member of the European community, the European Union. Are you confident? Are Irish people pretty confident? The Irish government pretty confident that the EU as a trading pact can actually make very strong moves to deal with the US? I mean, do you believe in what you're part of in tackling all this?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I said earlier that by far our most important relationship is with the European Union, because we're not part of the UK. We're not part of the US. We never will be. And, you know, Ireland has not just the general experience of the EU operating effectively as it did, for example, in relation to COVID, but the very specific experience recently on Brexit, where the European Union was immensely supportive of the Irish government's efforts to ensure that there wouldn't be a new hard border on the island of Ireland. Of course, the EU, you can't predict the future. You can't predict that Trump will make the US more wealthy. You certainly can't predict that. Likewise, you can't predict how damaged the European Union might be, but you can predict that the European Union is an extremely experienced negotiator, that it will operate together, that it's one of the most important markets in the world, and that the interests of Ireland and other member states will be taken into account.
We will see how it fares in the new environment. Bobby, thanks for being with us. Bobby McDonough there. A reminder that you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, for almost three decades, the US has been caught up in what's called the opioid epidemic. Around 645,000 Americans died from overdoses of addictive prescription painkillers. Whole communities were devastated and families destroyed. And one particular company, Purdue Pharma, was blamed by many health officials for knowingly selling the drugs that did much of the damage. Well, now the latest stage has been reached in the long legal battle to get compensation from Purdue and from the Sackler family that founded it, an agreement to pay $7.4 billion. This latest agreement, which still needs bankruptcy court approval, is $1.4 billion bigger than a previous deal that was struck between the parties. That deal fell apart. The new settlement was agreed between more than a dozen U.S. states and other individuals who'd filed cases against the company. Marty Schladen, senior reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, told me what's different about this deal.
Well, the one that the court knocked down before, they did so because that settlement would immunize the Sackler family going forward, where in this case, it's a bit more money, but it doesn't immunize the Sacklers. However, it does build in an $800 million legal defense fund for them.
Right. So is it potential still that this deal could in fact fall apart before it comes into action, or is that it? Is it done?
No, there's great potential for it to fall apart. Only so far, I think it's like 15 attorneys general, state attorneys general have signed on to it. A lot more still need to. Everything about these cases can be extremely complex and unwieldy.
And this has been going on a really long time, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I used to work for the Columbus Dispatch, and Ohio is one of the states that's been most ravaged by the opioid epidemic. And this litigation was starting when I got there in 2017, maybe even before.
And will, you know, the families who've been affected by this, I mean, it's a hugely tragic story, what's happened with the opioid epidemic. Are they likely to see any of this money anytime soon?
I think there have been payouts to the families, but a lot of this money is going to remediate the damage done, because this has also cost local governments a lot. We've also had to, of course, really expand drug treatment and that sort of thing. And I don't know that what we've got so far is even adequate.
Well, yeah, I mean, just give me a sense, if you could, Marty, because I know you've covered this for a long time. You know what's been going on. I mean, how bad has the effect of these opioids been in places like Ohio?
It's just devastated families, and it's not just, you know, poor people. I've got a childhood friend whose son got tangled up, and they sent him. He was 16 years old, a very bright boy, good-looking kid. They sent him to rehab in Florida, and he ran away from the place, and they found him dead in the surf. If you're a parent, how do you come back from something like that?
It is extraordinary, and is there a feeling amongst those people who have suffered like that, and of course, as you say, local authorities as well, that this will be justice? $7.4 billion is a lot of money.
Well, but there's another way of looking at it. According to my Google research, the Sackler family is worth somewhere between $11 billion and $13 billion. So even after they pay out this money, they'll be billionaires. They'll still be billionaires, I should say. And so I think there's a strong undercurrent here that the rich and the powerful never have to pay the way, first of all, the families of the people who died have. But even, you know, the doctors who are running pill mills, a lot of them are in prison. You know, I think many have lost their medical licenses. So it's like, you know, the severest consequences have all manifested farther down the economic and power ladder.
Marty Schladen there of the Ohio Capital Journal. Let's have a look at what's been going on the share markets. Kerry Leahy, economist at Columbia University, with me once again. Kerry, thanks for being with us. Another record high for the S&P.
It really is another example of today. We really believe in American exceptionalism today. And so you hit a new high on the S&P. And, you know, it seems like happy days are here again. Almost every day Trump makes an announcement.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because so many economists are saying, well, yes, you know, he talks a lot about tariffs, particularly. That could add to inflation pressures. The Fed is calculating its interest rate situation. This could all cause major problems for inflation, everything else. Is it still something that people on Wall Street support?
They understand that that could happen in sort of a worst case scenario, but they are basically taking the most Panglossian view about what's going on, and that much of what Trump's saying that would normally be very bad for the market, like inflation, is just a club he's using to get the kinds of deals he wants to make without actually having to do all the bad things they worry about, which may be inflationary, like tariffs and deportations.
So currently, the people, sort of people, I suppose, in tech particularly, of course, we saw at the inauguration, they're very much on the Trump train.
Yes, well, the whole idea that Republicans like reduced regulation is certainly the case with Trump. And in particular, he's interested in a lot of the stuff they're interested in, particularly in technology. And he likes talking to other billionaires, being a billionaire himself. And so they're really just enjoying the fact that this administration may help their group more than any other group in America over the next couple of years.
And one, I suppose, fly in the ointment at the moment, Boeing, they warned their fourth quarter loss was being unexpected because they've been dealing with a strike. That's a company that's still having trouble.
Yes, and no one seems to have any easy, not easy, or even a hard way out for the for the company, and they just have months and quarters, if not years, of time to fix the problem.
Thanks very much, Kerry. Kerry Leahy, their economist at Columbia University, joining us here on World Business Report. Now, climbing the world's highest mountain used to be a dream of mankind. In recent years, it's become almost routine, with several hundred people climbing Everest every year. But for Nepal, while the steady flow of climbers has become a vital source of income, there is a downside. Mount Everest has become littered with rubbish, while overcrowding has led to climbers being forced to queue in dangerous conditions close to the summit. Now, Nepal has decided to increase the cost of climbing permits from $11,000 to $15,000. Dr. Shauna Burke was just the second Canadian woman to get to the summit of Everest, so I asked her if she thought the price hike is a good thing.
Well, I have to say, I don't think it comes as a surprise to the climbing community. I think it's the first time in nearly a decade that there has been an increase. The income from permit fees is a key source of revenue for Nepal. The mountain trekking and climbing really makes a significant contribution to the country's economy. Having said that, I think I would be surprised if the price increase will actually slow the demand of climbers on the mountain. I know Nepal, the government has very much been criticized for allowing too many climbers on the mountain. But I think this increase in permit fees is unlikely to discourage climbers.
Yeah, it's two things in a way, isn't it? Obviously, as you say, to bring in income. But also, I mean, do you think there are too many people going up and down Everest?
I think the mountain has become overcrowded.
Which is extraordinary, considering it's the tallest mountain, or highest mountain, I should get my terms right, on the planet. I mean, that is bizarre, isn't it, really, that it becomes, I think, something like 800 people a year climbing it.
That's correct. There's about 300 permits that are issued by the government per year, which means that there's a lot of climbers on the mountain, and overcrowding can lead to very dangerous conditions on the mountain. And I think that is one of the issues that is a concern for the climbing community, is that there are too many climbers on the mountain, and often a lot of those climbers are inexperienced.
So too many, meaning that it's just wearing things out, or is it to do with the amount of rubbish that's left behind?
It's a combination of factors. So rubbish is a key issue. We are seeing that the mountain in particular is becoming polluted, and that is very much a concern. I think as well what you do see on the mountain is what's called bottlenecks. So, for example, when climbers are climbing to the summit and they're going for the summit push, if there's too many climbers on the mountain at the same time, it can create these bottlenecks on the mountain where it will take hours for climbers to be able to get through certain sections on the mountain, which means that getting to the summit in that window of time when they need to get to the top before bad weather can come in or before darkness sets in becomes very difficult. So if there are too many climbers on the mountain, it can become dangerous.
So is the answer then, do you think, actually to put the fee up much, much more so that it will limit the numbers of people there, both to obviously avoid wearing things out, but also for safety and also to stop pollution?
Well, I guess the key question really is how is the extra revenue going to be generated by these permits? How is it going to be used by the government? And to me, there are two key issues. And I think the first one is very much around protecting the environment. And I think the second one is around improving the safety of climbers. So I think ultimately it's how that revenue is going to be used.
And is the revenue they get at the moment being used in the right way?
Well, there has been an improvement in terms of trying to improve the pollution that is on the mountain and all the trash. So I know in 2019, the Nepalese army actually began conducting an annual cleanup of the mountain. Although there are still 200 bodies that remain on the mountain, I know a number of corpses have been collected. I know hundreds of tons of rubbish have been taken off the mountain. The government as well, it was in 1991, set up the Sagarmatha Pollution Control Committee to help keep the whole Khumbu region, where Everest is located, to help keep it clean. But more still needs to be done. We need to see more efforts.
Dr. Shauna Burke there, who climbed Everest, in fact the second Canadian woman to do it, telling us why, well, perhaps they should charge even a little bit more to climb that mountain. That's it from World Business Report.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.